Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 5 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'd just like to thank everyone for tuning in and being an encouraging audience over the last few years, and I'm sure you will enjoy this season as well. We'll take some deep musical dives together in the coming months, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of these conversations I've been having with some incredible musicians and music producers with you. We have a couple of continuing sponsors that help to bring you each episode this season. The first is Union Tube and Transistor, making incredible guitar effect pedals out of Vancouver, BC. My old pal Chris Young at Union has been laying stuff on me for years, starting with his prototype Buzz Bomb pedal about 15 years ago. Since then, he's become a leading light in boutique pedal manufacturers with an extensive line of pedals like the Moore pedal, the Lab compressor, and the Sone Bender that are constants in my recording world. Check out their line of pedals at uniontone.com. And the second sponsor for the season is Black Mountain Thumb Picks. I've been using these myself for several months, and I think they're great. Cole McBride, the owner, is trying to make everybody happy and now has medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz tipped, left-handed, and regular and extra tight spring tensions available. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. So even though I've been doing this podcast for about 5 years, my heart just isn't into hounding companies for advertising dollars. So as always, this show mostly relies on listener support to keep going. And thanks to everyone that has done that in the past, it's a huge help to know that there's people out there willing to kick in to make it all possible. So if you're interested in doing so, there's a few simple ways to help out. First of all, please just tell your music nerd pals about this show. Word of mouth is probably the best way to get the show heard more. If you're in a position to kick in a bit financially, you can make a one-time donation or join in on my Patreon account, which is a monthly donation billed directly to your credit card at any amount of your choice. You'll also get access through Patreon to some private videos and other stuff as I make it available. And the third way that you can help out is to buy a t-shirt or other swag as it comes available. You can have a look at those or make a donation or join the Patreon, all at the new website, which is www.makersandshakerspodcast.com. And please don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get them from. And while you're at it, folks, don't forget to have a listen to our offshoot show called One Life, featuring Jim Burns. It's a fun concept podcast involving live improvised music and off-the-cuff storytelling. I think you might dig it. And finally, please follow the show on social media. I have links to Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook all on the website, as well as a YouTube link. And that YouTube channel actually is going to get a bit more action this year. In the past, I've just put up links to some live performances, but I will be starting a video series this year about music and recording that I think you might dig. So please subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. Links are all at the top of the page at www.makersandshakerspodcast.com and at my personal website, which is stevedawson.ca. So that's about it for the biz side of things. Let's get going. On to this week's show. Greetings, everybody. Thank you for joining me. This is episode 105 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. Steve Dawson coming to you here from the Hen House in Nashville. A stormy day here in Tennessee. And today we have the incredible good fortune to have Mr. Bill Payne on the show. And Bill is one of the founding members and the keyboard player from Little Feet, of course, and also was one of the top call session players through the 70s and 80s and 90s, and still to this day does a ton of sessions and has remained incredibly busy and creative. And it was amazing to be able to speak to him about all that stuff. I hope everyone's doing well out there and staying busy and creative and maybe finding some sort of normalcy coming back into your lives. I don't know. Sometimes I think there is and sometimes not so much. I've been doing these remote sessions called the Hen House Express, where me and some compadres record music for people remotely. They send their song in and we track guitars and drums and basses and I mix them and we send them back. It's been a lot of fun, so we're continuing to do that. I've also recorded 3 albums, weirdly. A couple of albums worth of songs and 1 album of pedal steel instrumental music. It's been a lot of fun doing stuff remotely with Gary Craig in Toronto, Jay Bellarose in Los Angeles, Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver, Kevin McHenry, who's not far away, but still doing stuff remotely with him, Fats Kaplan, Daniel Lapp, all kinds of great musicians and artists. So it's been really fun working with people on productions that I've been doing, but also I've been chipping away at some of my own stuff. So I've got these 3 records and I'll start the process of releasing those fairly soon and I'll let you know what's up with that. All right, so on the show this month, we have a 2-part episode with the great Bill Payne. Little Feat, for me, has been a huge influence. Lowell George was probably in my top 3 or 4 slide guitar influences of my life. And as a result, I followed Little Feat very closely. I mean, I didn't follow them because, you know, I was like 3 when they were doing their thing. When I got into guitar, it took me a little while to get to Little Feat because they weren't at the top of the visibility heap as far as like big rock bands go. And so, you know, it was like 1 or 2 steps back from like the Stones and Cream and Hendrix. And pretty soon you start hearing people like the Rolling Stones talking about Little Feat. And then, of course, being a teenager getting into music, I was curious and checked out Little Feat and realized how wicked they were. And that began my deep dive into the many great records and the musicianship of Lowell and Bill Payne and Richie Hayward. And the entire crew of the band is phenomenal. And they had an incredible chemistry and made a lot of great records. Some of the greatest records of the 70s, I think. And I've always thought that Dixie Chicken was one of the greatest sounding records. It's soulful. The songs are incredible. But sonically, it's super deep and rich, and I keep going back to it. It's one of those records that, you know, you can revisit it 5-6 years after not hearing it and find all kinds of new tidbits of awesome things in it. And so for me, that's one that I just keep coming back to, and I'm always amazed at how killer that record sounds. Hopefully you know that record. If you don't, go check it out. And then they broke up. Lowell George died in the mid-80s, and then they reformed in the late 80s, and they made a kick-ass record called Let It Roll that was also big for me because at that time I was old enough to actually, you know, see Little Feat, and they were around, and they toured and kind of reinvented themselves and then had this whole other wave of their career. So it's been a real roller coaster for Bill, and in the middle of all that, somehow he maintained a career playing in a big rock band like that, but also being one of the top call session players. But he played on records for J.J. Cale, the Doobie Brothers, Emmylou Harris, all those great early Emmylou Harris records, Pink Floyd, Bob Seger, Linda Ronstadt, that cool trio album that we've talked about on the show before with Linda Ronstadt, Dolly Parton, and Emmylou Harris. He's all over that. He's played on Bonnie Raitt records, Stevie Nicks. He talks in the interview about playing on a Butthole Surfers record, which piqued my curiosity. And I really looked, and I can't find Bill Payne playing on a Butthole Surfers record. But he talks about it. He also says that T-Bone Burnett produced the session for the Butthole Surfers. And not only can I not find Bill Payne playing on a Butthole Surfers record, but I can't find any mention of T-Bone Burnett working on a Butthole Surfers record. So come on, nerds, somebody out there can probably tell me what that is all about. I'll ask Bill if I get a chance, but I'm sure he's right. I just can't find any mention of it, but it certainly sounds intriguing. Bill's also a great songwriter and photographer. He's been doing a lot of photography lately. You can get information on his own stuff, both with Little Feat and his solo music and his photography stuff at BillPayneCreative.com. That's BillPayneCreative.com. And of course, you can find all the information on Little Feat that you want at littlefeat.net. And that's Little Feat with an F-E-A-T. Come on, you know that. He's also a great songwriter and wrote some of the classic Little Feat numbers, Oh Atlanta, Tripe Face Boogie, Time Loves a Hero. He co-wrote a lot of songs with with Lowell George, especially in the first record. They co-wrote a ton of songs, Strawberry Flats. The great instrumental that I love off Dixie Chicken, Lafayette Railroad, is a co-write between Bill and Lowell George. I'd just like to shout out to some of the recent financial supporters of the show. Of course, we can't do it without you. And I mentioned at the top of the show how you can contribute if you feel so inclined. Over the last month or so, we've had some people kick in, and I just wanted to thank Paul Cuddiford, Mike Abbas, Stephanie Cushing, Nicholas Zaromsky. I hope I got all your names right. Thank you so much for your support, and thanks to everybody for pitching in. And now, on to the show. Please enjoy part one of my conversation with Bill Payne. Thank you so much for doing this. I've been a big fan of your work for so many years. It's great to be able to talk to you about some of this stuff.
Well, thanks. It's always a pleasure to have a conversation.
I wondered if maybe, you know, you could talk a little bit about what you've been up to over the last year. I mean, things have been so crazy for everybody. It's been interesting to get a read from different people about how they've, you know, sort of filled up the time creatively and professionally. And I know you're doing a lot of photography these days as well. And I'd just like to kind of know how the last year has been for you and, you know, what you've been up to in the last bit.
Well, my year started out in Jamaica with Little Feet. And it, from there, a few weeks later, actually, it wasn't that long. I was in Las Vegas with the Doobie Brothers.
And oh, right. You're still playing with those guys.
Yeah. We were doing a stint down there, and it was Chinese New Year. We heard about this virus, and it was nuts. So Tommy got sick. I don't think he didn't come down with the virus, but we had to cancel shows. So
okay.
I had one more gig in Philadelphia on March 7th.
Yeah.
At a club. I was like, gosh, should I fly? Okay, I'll fly back there. And we're all hugging each other. So
the last hug you ever gave, probably.
Yeah, the New Orleans Suspects and Fred Tackett was there. It was a really great gathering. I thought, well, who's going to show up to this club? Well, the club was packed, and thankfully, I didn't have the virus. A good friend of mine, Larry Campbell, did, however.
Oh, right, I heard about that. Yeah,
and so that was not good. Jackson Brown came down with something from another gig in New York.
Yeah.
When I got back, which was on March 8th or 9th, I think it was about the 10th, the bottom fell out.
Yeah.
My birthday was on March 12th, might have even been the 11th. When the NBA canceled their season, I went, uh-oh, something's really amiss here. So we figured out that this was completely going to be a horrible year. But as you said, it opened up the door to other things.
Yeah.
So my writing, I've been writing a bit more. Mm-hmm. I'm finishing up a piece on a guy that tunes my piano, which is my piano is right next to me here.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
So this. What kind of piano is that?
It's a Yamaha seven footer. I played it on a couple of Emmy Lou Harris's first records.
Right on.
Boulder to Birmingham. And,
yeah, yeah.
Et cetera. At any rate, yeah, so I've been writing about different people. This guy tunes the piano. I've been doing stuff with the Doobie Brothers. I learned how to set up microphones and
Get
them on the piano. I've got my
it's about time, Bill.
Yeah, I know. I tell people, it's like driving Miss Daisy. You got the best engineers in the world. I'm in the back seat going, turn left here. And they drive the car, but I've had to drive it. I just finished all the cues for a grizzly bear documentary called The Beast of Our Time.
Oh, cool.
Doug Peacock is in it. Jeff Bridges did the narration.
Right on.
I think Jeff was probably, had just found out he had cancer, but valiantly did his part in that film.
Okay.
Michael Middleton is the director. But anyway, I was doing everything from here. I sent it back to Charles Martinez. And Charles is Little Feet's engineer. He's also Donald Fagen's engineer.
Oh, okay.
From Steely
Dan. Up in Woodstock.
Yes, exactly. So I've got a Woodstock connection that won't quit. In fact, that with Little Feet, we've put out one video, which was of our own. It was the old Lowell George tune, Long Distance Love, which I thought was appropriate for the times.
Sure.
We've got another one we're working on entitled When All Boats Rise, which is also appropriate for everything. This will have all my photography in it. Dick Bangham is working on the graphics of the video, which is to say, if you have an eagle flying into a tree, a static shot of that, he'll remove the eagle and then have it look like it is flying in.
Oh, wow, cool.
It's a wonderful technology. But yeah, all kinds of bits and pieces of that of nature, recording with other bands occasionally.
Are you doing any remote sessions or anything like that?
I have not. I mean, I've done only, not where I sit and play and broadcast it. I've thought about it a couple times, but I'd like to get the sound a little better. I mean, I think it's okay to have it seem like you're coming from your living room or your music room, where literally you are. But I would just like to
bump it up a few notches first.
But when we did our first video with Little Feet, the reason I did it, Scott Sherrard, who's in our band.
Yeah.
He said, some guys he'd done a video with, an old Fred Tackett song, Fool Yourself, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we went ahead and I said, well, let me see it. And I took a look and I go, God, you know, it looks okay, but it sounds great.
Right.
So it had all the boxes, you know, everybody's in box level. It's a Brady Bunch style. And but I liked the way it sounded. So I said, well, Little Feet should do one. And that was the song I thought we should do. We also made a change in drummers. We brought in Tony Leone, who's mm-hmm. also from New York area. And he's played with Chris Robinson and played with, I've seen him down in Jamaica many times, up in New York many times.
Yeah.
So he's playing with us. He's a joy to work with. So yeah, a lot of things, a lot of changes. And just, I think I've learned a little more patience in dealing with the flow of things.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I find everything I do takes,
it takes a while. It's just,
it takes a while.
That's okay. Maybe it's good. You know, I haven't quite fathomed that out yet, but really taking a few steps backwards, it's good.
Has there been any talk of Little Feet shows or anything like that? Or are you just waiting to see how it all turns out?
We're waiting. There are a lot of bands have like what I'm calling markers that are out there. Mm-hmm. In the future, Scott Sherrard is really good at keeping me up to date on that stuff. And that's nice. But I said, look, they're markers. They're, you know, nobody knows what's going on yet. I have great hopes like everybody else that we'll be able to play some shows this year.
Yeah.
I'm on the books with the Doobie Brothers for July.
Okay. So they're sticking to that for now.
We're sticking to that for now. As our other bands, I think Donald Fagen and Steely Dan have got some dates as early as April.
Wow, that's I
think
ambitious.
It's ambitious, but I really do. I mean, no offense to Donald or anybody else, but
yeah.
Well, let's see where it goes. I'll be ready to play when.
Can you tell me what the current lineup of Little Feet is then? Like who are the latest additions?
The latest additions are the two new members, Scott Sherrard, who was, I met playing with the Doobie Brothers. We did a tour with Greg Allman. He was the MD for that. We also have, as I said, Tony Leone from Chris Robinson from,
he's drumming.
Yeah. He's playing drums.
Uh-huh.
And then the rest are Sam Clayton's on congas, Fred Tackett on various guitars, mandolins, et cetera.
Yeah.
Kenny Grady, of course, on bass.
Yeah.
So that's about it. I guess it's Six Musketeers.
And are you doing all the Paul Bearer tunes and all that stuff? Is that what Scott Sherrard does?
What we will do is I think we're going to go back and learn a few albums actually.
Okay.
And record them again, but record them live.
Oh, cool. Okay.
We'll also record a new record of which we've gotten a start on, which is When All Boats Rise is part of that effort. I've been singing like Josh, Fat Man in the Bathtub.
Nice.
A bunch of stuff that I've never sung in my life. I sang Willin' on this last
tour
we did in October of last year. And, you know, I was literally going from a Doobie Brothers tour on up to Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And I sung in the shower. I don't know. I told people, I said, look, you know, I've got the lyrics in front of me on an iPad. And if I don't hit the mark that evening, well, then we'll have somebody else sing it.
I've always enjoyed the Bill Payne singing moments in the classic Little Feat stuff, too. Whoa. You know, like.
It's all fun. It's, I mean, you know, when you're listening to Lowell George, you're trying to.
That's, yeah.
You can't drop Lowell.
Say no more.
It was ridiculous with his phrasing.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a genius at it. I'm not bad at phrasing, but you know, I'm not low. So that's
very few are.
Yeah, it's not a matter of that. It's a matter of what do you feel comfortable sharing with an audience, and what do you have to say?
Right.
That's what being in a band and being a performer is about.
Exactly.
Pure and simple. And if you have the impetus just still say something and have people that can help you say it, and you help them say what they need to project out there.
Yeah. And you've got a supportive, huge fan base of people that have been with you for years and years, and they want to hear that stuff.
They do. So we're blessed on a lot of levels. And when the doors open up again, we'll be there.
Yeah. Speaking of Lowell, like maybe we could talk about some of your early days. I know you were born in Texas, right? And moved pretty early to California, I think, when you were just a little tyke. So at what point did you start playing piano? Was piano your first instrument?
Yeah, I started playing, taking lessons when I was about five.
Okay.
Probably edging up on six, but five. And Ruth Newman was my teacher in Ventura, California.
That's where you lived, Ventura?
Yeah. We moved to California. I started crawling a little earlier than that. At age two, I was kind of walking and crawling. Late start. My parents followed me out to California. I was at a den of wolves, and then they extracted me from that particular scene, and we wound up in Ventura. So I was taking piano lessons there, and Ruth did a rather important thing. She said, at my first lesson, she says, what would you like to play for me? So I played her the theme from Davy Crockett.
Nice.
And she said, look, when you come back next week, I'll have this written out for you, which she did. This is what you played. I know you can't read it yet, but this is why we're going to set some music in front of you and show you where those notes are. But she also later told my mother a really important thing, too. She said, you know, about whether I should just be reading music or improvising or both. She said, let's let him improvise. I'll make sure he knows how to play and read notes. And I'll introduce him to Bach, Beethoven, etc. But let's not take the magic out of it for him.
Ah, cool. You need somebody like that.
You really do, because, I mean, I ask people who've taken piano before, I said, how many times were you were you ever hitting on the hand with a ruler? And I said, yes. And I go, not a great way to teach a child
piano. No, not so much. But I guess back in those days, like that was maybe like what teachers were like.
They were. Mine wasn't, thankfully. And at age 10, I started playing pipe organ at the Presbyterian Church. Well, with regard to that and how it relates to who I am as a musician today, I play multi-keyboard. So I've got it. I thought I had four or five manuals in front of me. The church organ in Ventura now only has three, I believe. But they've done some reworking on it. And it used to be up in the loft. It's down on the ground floor now. I mean, things have changed.
Yeah.
And, I can't find anybody that really remembers what anything was like back in the day, which is the early 60s. So the curve I had is a learning period was extended through when I joined my first band at age 15.
Okay. So how was she encouraging you to improvise? Like, what were you given a framework or a context to do that with? Or was just play whatever you feel like?
Yeah, play what you feel like. And if you want to, if you have any questions about what you're doing, let me know.
And at the same time, she was giving you the knowledge of, like, you were getting classically trained to a certain extent, or like
to a large extent.
Okay.
I'll show you if you can see it over there, all those books. Oops.
Oh, yeah.
That's
a big old stack.
That's all music. So I don't know if I played last night or not, other than to fix two or three cues on this movie where they extended the footage to it just minutely, but it threw a few things out of kilter. So, on the piano, I've got some Mozart, some Bach on the side.
And are you a good reader? Like, is that something you've kept up with over the years?
I'm not a great reader, but I can read.
Yeah.
And I've read the fugues. I mean, not all of them, but book one, a bunch.
Wow, cool.
There's some Beethoven sonatas I've played over the years. And I've always done it to where to augment the chops I have as a keyboard player.
Yeah.
My hands are pretty small.
They are small.
Not to do a Donald Trump here, but.
It's enough of that guy.
Funny guy. No.
You mentioned getting into a band when you were about 15. What was your first band that you were in?
It was called the Debonairs.
Okay.
It is a good story. As most of them are, I think. But the gag was that I showed up at this rehearsal. I just had a really horrible incident down in Ventura. This was the band I joined was in Santa Maria, but I just lost my music teacher. Ruth had died of a heart attack. Really in the last 6 to 8 months found out she was, I think, 56 or 57 years of age.
Wow.
Which is pretty darn young.
That's so young.
At my age, when I'm going to be 72 in March. So there was that angst and I just anger and just discombobulation.
So you'd become really close with her, obviously.
Oh, yeah. She was like a second mother to me.
Wow.
And when we moved to Santa Maria, when I was going into my first year of high school, I did a half semester in Ventura, then up to Santa Maria. So I was coming back to Ventura for piano lessons. And in the midst of that, she had passed away.
Wow.
So I got really, really drunk one night. And cops, thank God they found us, or I would have died because they took me to the hospital, pumped my stomach.
Ugh.
And my friends, I woke up on their living room floor and D and his brother Gar and Burdette, their dad, they're all looking at me and laughing. And I'm going, all hail to Santa Maria. Let's go them. And so my parents pick me up and we go. And on the way up, they were going, man, this kid's in deep distress. We got a call from one of your classmates. Jim, I can't think of his last name. I've got it somewhere, but he's forming a band, and he'd like to know if you want to audition for it.
Oh wow! Okay.
So that was their way of trying to bring me out of this funk that I was in.
Right. Was that a repeating thing? Like, were you kind of going off the rails a little bit as a youngster, or was that just a one-off?
No, it was not. I think I was a fragile human being.
Yeah.
Best way to put it. Used to getting things I wanted sometimes, was viewed as a musician, which is to say as an artist. The woodshop teacher would say, seventh grade, Bill, I'm going to give you a passing grade, but stay away from the saws.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
That kind of thing. You're going, oh, yeah. Gosh, okay. But so I went to the audition to play drums.
Oh.
And
had you played drums before?
A little bit. I liked it. So I thought, okay, I'll So we're playing and we take a break, and there's a
piano. This is a rock and roll band.
A rock and roll band. There's a piano up against the wall. I wander over to it, and just aimlessly while I'm standing there, I don't even sit down, I'm standing there, I start to play it. And they go, wait a minute, you play the piano? I go, well, sort of. I mean, I was 15, I've been playing it for 10, you know, 10
You're
years.
You're a pro, seasoned vet at that point.
Well, I played Rachmaninoff and, you know, some of the Pathetique, Beethoven. I mean, I knew my stuff, and I was a pretty good improviser even then, even without being in a band. Mm-hmm. Just sitting and playing. And they went, okay, this band, we're dissolving right this second. We're going to start up a band down the street. It's going to be called the Debonairs. The fellow that has the garage and all the gear is going to be our point guy.
Yeah.
You're going to play keyboards in that band. And I go, okay. And that's how it started.
Were you into the rock and roll stuff, or was it sort of a foreign world to you, or where was your head at?
No, man. My sister was 9 years older than me. So when Elvis Presley came out with Hound Dog.
You were into it.
Oh, totally into it. Although I would fully admit that as much as I loved the music, which I did, I was as enamored of the little dog on the RCA, listening to the gramophone as I was the music.
Sure.
I also was one of those guys that would listen to radio shows, and we had rotary phones. So you're like, well, take the first caller. And so I'd already be the guy that would dial every number but the last digit and you let go.
Yeah.
And the first record I won was The Ghost of Billy Malou, sung by Dorsey Burnett. Years later, I ran into Billy Burnett, who was his son.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah,
Billy was briefly with, or I don't know how brief, but he was with Fleetwood Mac for a while.
Right.
Told him about it. He goes, really? You got that record of my dad's? I go, yeah, man. It was a contest. Dick Shipley was the DJ. I met him. He's like, you know, all pockmarked face. He had the Bill Evans kind of black comb back hair, dark glasses. I mean, not dark glasses, not darkened sunglasses, but just 50s kind of looking guy.
Right.
And I was, you know, just like, oh gosh, what a cool thing. So I always wanted to be a DJ at one point.
So what happened with that band? Like, did you guys start playing around California a bunch, or just kept it super local?
It was all Santa Maria. In fact, most of the bands I played in, Santa Maria, Something Wild was another group. When I first joined Little Feet, Elliot Ingber, who was with the Mothers, the original Mothers of Invention, came over to Lowell's house, and he had this little record. He says, is this you on this record? And I go, yeah, Elliot. I go, where the hell did you find that? He says, in one of those bins, and I got it because it said Psychedelic Records, Acid Head Productions. And I said, well,
what was it? What was the record?
It was by Something Wild, and it was She's Kind of Weird, and I forget what was on the other side.
So you had a little bit of studio experience with these early bands.
I mean, very little. I mean, it was little enough to be, you know, nil, but a little studio experience, an actual record that was out.
Did it do anything? Like, did it get any airplay?
It didn't really do too much, but I got to say that Something Wild is one of those, there are, like everything else in life, see, there's these genres of people that all they study are middle California, mid-coast California bands. I'm trying to say this. So that's where, I mean, Elliot wasn't one of those guys, but I told him flat out, I said, look, I had no idea what psychedelic was any more than I knew what Acid Head Productions were until maybe 6 months, a year later. And then I finally got I was baptized in the LSD, Church of LSD.
It was around then.
Yes.
So where did you meet Lowell for the first time?
I made more or less an appointment to see him.
Really?
I was sleeping on the beach in Santa Barbara, up in Isla Vista, to be precise, on a beach called Haskell's, which now has a big Holiday Inn there. I had a phony credit card, of the kind that Steve, you know, that, you know, the cats that formed Apple.
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs. They had the same kind of card. It wasn't literally a credit card. It was just a card so you can make calls from phone booths.
Yeah. Okay.
So I got one somehow. And I called up, there was two record labels that I was going to call, both of them Frank Zappa labels. Mm-hmm. One was Bizarre, the other was Straight.
Okay.
I called Bizarre.
Called them for what?
To say, hey, my name is Bill Payne. I'm sleeping on the beach. I know how to play the piano. And can you help me? And through a few conversations, it turned out that the secretary there took pity on me and said, I'll line you up to meet Lowell George.
Okay.
And or this guy named Lowell George, who's been asked to leave the Mothers and form his own band.
So he'd already been, that had already happened. Like he'd already
that
been
had happened
to,
or was in the process of happening. So I had an aborted attempt at somebody else they'd introduced me to, which was Jeffrey Simmons, who was in a group called Eureka.
Okay.
That was in one of Frank's satellite bands, because he'd do these shows and he'd have all these different groups that he was interested in play these shows.
Okay.
So at any rate, I set up this appointment to meet Lowell. I go to his house. There's a.
So they just gave you his phone number and said, phone this guy.
Yeah, call him up. And I said, okay. So there I was again. And one of the secretaries that I had talked to, I saw her like many years later when I was playing with Bob Seger.
Yeah.
And earning like, you know, a six figure salary.
Yeah.
And I just thanked her. I said, I don't know what I would have done had you not.
It's pretty amazing that it really.
It's like Dickinson can, tale is what it is. It's,
yeah. You can pinpoint one phone call that kind of changed your life.
Yeah. And it was just, but you when you have dreams, it's one thing to have a dream, but how do you connect that dream to reality? And so if you want to be, I want to be a concert pianist. Okay, cool. What do you need to do to get there? My right. instincts told me that in order to join a band, which I tried to do before that,
yeah,
in Northern California, and it just didn't work because the people that I had been introduced to were groovy dope dealers, but they didn't play the instruments very well. And they lived in a great place and they're all really nice people. But I heard the album Uncle Meat, and I went, that's the stuff I want to play.
Right, right.
And I go, oh, God damn it, they're in L.A. So I got to go to Los Angeles. I said I'd never live there. I lived there for 33 years.
Yeah, man, you're a L.A. veteran.
Yeah, of sorts. And
what was that initial meeting with Lowell like? Like, did you guys hit it off? And
We did indeed. I showed up at the front door. The door was open. It was a rustic house on Rowena Drive near Silver Lake. It wasn't in Silver Lake. It was the next little thing over. There was a beautiful blonde girl, kind of shortish blonde hair, sitting cross-legged on the floor, listening to Eric Satie.
Wow, that's quite an image.
I said, well, you know, you must be Bill. Lowell's expecting you. I go, oh, cool. He'll be back in 4 or 5 hours. I said, well, what does he do when he's not expecting you? So I walked and chatted with her for a while. I wandered around the house. He had a sitar in the right corner of the back part of the home. That evidently he was studying with Ravi Shankar. He had samurai sword on the back wall itself. A list of books that I, you know, poetry by Carl Sandburg and Allen Ginsberg. Uh-huh. He had some records, a Lenny Bruce record.
Of course.
You know, John Coltrane, Ohm, some great blues records with Chester Burnett, you know, Helen Wolf and Muddy Waters, of course. The series that the Smithsonian were putting out, Chain Gang music. Mm-hmm. Hey, Lordy, join the band. That was on one of those records.
Okay. Yeah.
Which we later used as our intro for Waiting for Columbus.
Waiting for Columbus, yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of things. So by the time Lowell showed up, to finally answer your question, it was
and
like...
It was 4 or 5 hours later?
Oh, it was. And I kind of felt like I knew him when he arrived. And I'm reminded of a story Fidel Castro and Che Guevara, when they first met. They talked about everything under the sun. Mm-hmm. They had a real affinity for one another, and it wasn't one subject that either one of them could bring up that the other couldn't hold a conversation with. That's exactly right. The way it was with Lowell and I.
You guys were instant buddies.
Yeah, but I didn't join the band instantly. I wanted to meet Frank Zappa. So okay. About, I'd say a month, 2 months later.
Were you kind of envisioning joining the Mothers? Is that kind of what
I
you had in
That's
mind?
The reason I went to L.A. Entertaining thoughts of L.A. And because Lowell was leaving the band, they said, look, Frank's over in Europe. Why don't we introduce you to somebody else that's played with him? See what you think of that. Frank will be back in about a month or whenever it's going to be, and maybe we can set you up to meet him or see what happens at that time. I actually did get to meet Frank, which was really wonderful. I had already made the decision to play with Lowell, and I don't even know if we had the name Little Feet at that time.
And was it just you and him, or did you guys have like Roy Estrada and those guys?
No, we went through about 14, 16 bass players the first year. One of whom was
that's a lot.
It was one of whom was Paul Barrere.
And really?
I set some music in front of that Stravinsky himself couldn't have read, and it was called "Dance of the Nubile Virgin Slaves." And so it was more of a jaunt into instrumental music.
Yeah,
I think the very first real song that Lowell and I wrote was "Truck Stop Girl."
Wow, that's cool.
Which was a good one, and the Byrds recorded it.
So what was your writing process with Lowell like? Because like on that first Little Feet record, there's a whole ton of co-writes between the two of you guys.
There was. We'd sit there at his house and just kind of, his mother had a piano over there, which we completely destroyed once we started touring because we brought it out on the road.
You brought his mom's piano on tour?
On a couple of times. Yeah, but it was again, it was just playing around town.
Yeah.
you know, we didn't tour until 71, I think. Technically, and it was, in fact, technically it was 70 because it was December in the Reflections Club in Cincinnati. There's a whole other story there. But yeah, so we were writing a lot. By the time we got to the second album, Lowell wanted to do more writing on his own.
Right, yeah. So that sort of petered out after that. Like you did a lot of writing on your own.
He had his own vision of where he wanted to take it. He was a wonderful lyricist, a great songwriter.
Yeah.
We brought in, after Sailing Shoes, Richie and I brought in Paul Barrere to aid with the guitar work and stuff. Give Lowell a bit of a break there.
What led up to the first record? Was it a Zappa instigated thing where he signed you guys?
Frank was there as a distant helping hand.
Okay.
And maybe people that are closer to him would say he had more of a hand on it than I would have known or allude to now. But what happened was we talked to a lot of people. Ahmet Erdogan was one of the folks we talked to who produced Ray Charles. Well, yeah. I didn't know he produced Ray Charles, or I would have been too embarrassed to have presented our music to him, which at the time, a lot of it was very instrumental oriented and Frank Zappa-esque. And he's talking to Lowell and I. He's got his shoes on without any socks. And he goes, boys, it's too diverse. Okay, Ahmet. And we go back to the drawing board. And that's when we started writing actual songs, Strawberry Flats, Rise of Jesus, Captain Gunboat Willie, on and on.
So many cool songs.
Hamburger Midnight.
Yeah.
Started writing all those tunes, and which were just eclectic as hell. And eventually we were given an audience with Ted Templeman and Lenny Warnker. It might have been in Lenny's office, but
Warner Brothers?
Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
And we'd entertained a few other labels. We talked to Terry Melcher, who had some stuff going on. He flew to Europe, the Manson family.
Right.
Killed Sharon Tate and everybody. Like the next day or the day after the LaBianca family was murdered. There was a lot of very crazy stuff going on back then.
Yeah.
So, but Lowell and I went to Warner's. We played, I don't know, 6 to 8 songs. I'm playing piano. He's playing acoustic guitar.
Did you have the band yet? Or was this just, okay.
We didn't really have, well, Richie was in the band, but dig this. This will take me back to the first story. Richie's in the band and Lowell says, I want you to play on this record with the Fraternity of Man. They want you to play on this album. I go, yeah, well, Richie's with the Fraternity of Man, right? He says, yeah. I said, well, how's he supposed to be a little fee? Well, they're going to put out this album and they're all going to break up. I said, oh, I get it. Welcome to Hollywood. Kind of like what the band did up in Santa Maria. Oh, you play the piano? Forget about this group. We're going to do this group.
Okay.
It was just fly by the seat of your pants. You know, nobody knew what the hell they were doing, and yet we sure did. but it wasn't like, oh yeah, we're gonna appear on The Voice, and we're gonna work up. Oh no, sorry, you can't use it. They have their house band, you know, that kind of stuff. They had house bands back then. That's nothing new under the sun either. But it was just, and I'm not saying it's not any more or less honest than it was back then. Music is music. You can do a Milli Vanilli and fake your way through it up to a point, but most people know how to play.
Especially in those days too. Like, you couldn't really do that kind of a thing without being able to have your shit together.
Yeah, you really had to know how to play. And I think that a lot of guys, you know, Connor Kennedy's one of these cats that I work with back, you know, pre COVID. He's now in Steely Dan. Obviously, he knows how to play.
Yeah.
And Tony Leone was studying. He says, I've been studying Richie since I was 12 years old. Richie Hayward on drums. And I go, wow. So he's 50, I think, 51 now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it sets you back a few notches to go, my God, you know, there's some real history there. But I've always looked at music not so much as an age factor, is what do you bring to the table? What music have you surrounded yourself with? What other musicians have you played with? What are your tastes in food, politics, books, and art, and in life?
Important.
All important, because they all make up who you are as a human being.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you surround yourself with?
It tells you a lot about somebody's art.
Yeah, and who they are. And that's when I was cautioning people in that, the 2016 election, when I'm off, Hillary Clinton, forget her. I go, look at who she's surrounding herself with, okay? I don't care what you think of her. I mean, I do care, and I'm not saying what you should do. I'm just trying to point a direction that you might look at before you vote for Jill Stein or whatever her name was. If I'm going to hire somebody to do my plumbing, I want an actual guy or woman that knows politics and knows the system.
That's right.
Not somebody that's played a couple of choruses in a rock and roll band. It's not just Jill, by the way, either. We had a candidate here in Montana that got thrashed for the same reason. I mean, wonderful guy, I'm sure, singing cowboy. You know, look, I'm okay with that. I mean, Ronald Reagan was an actor. It's not your gig. It's what do you know about what it is you're going into to try and do. So if I'm going to play piano, I'm not going to go in there and play a ukulele because somebody thrusts it in front of me and goes, I know you're a musician, try this. It's practical stuff, that's all.
Can you give me a feel for what recording your first record was like? Like, you didn't have a ton of experience, you'd written these songs. From what I understand, Lowell had broken his hand or something, right? Because Ry Cooder plays on that record.
Ry plays on it. What happened with Lowell was he was flying airplanes, like little airplanes with engines on them, and rather than
like model airplanes,
but rather than have a remote control for it, he wouldn't have anything to do with the remote control. We'd just go to Griffith Park in the parking lot there, and he'd set the plane off, which it would fly till it ran out of gas, and then land and crash and miss hitting a parked car by a few inches. So Lowell was fixing one of those engines that had crashed into the ground. And the thing flew off the block. And,
oh,
and
shit.
Thank God he had a degree in a brown belt or something in judo or one of the martial arts. And he was able to save it from flying into his face. But it did cut the heck out of his hand.
And that was right before the session.
Yes. And so Rye, who also made his recording at, I think, what was Western at the time.
Yeah.
Richie had played on Rye's first album. So Rye was there.
Yeah.
And in New Russell, Russ Tidelman, and Russ and Law were at each other's throats.
Really?
So it was a very chaotic group of sessions. It was not fun.
So Russ was producing that record, and you guys just weren't kind of jiving or whatever?
Russ and Lowell, who knew each other and liked each other, dear, good friends from what I was told, just blew up on each other.
Just difference of opinion of direction of the music or what?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I later apologized to Russ, telling him, look, you know, I kind of demonized you at the time, but I was young. I didn't really know enough to.
How old were you when you did that first record? Like 19 or 20?
No, 21, I believe. I wasn't that young. But so yeah, I'm 21. I'm kind of freaked out. I'm living in a place I said I'd never live. I'm in a studio. Yeah, I want to make records. Now I'm really making them. And you know, the red light's on. You kind of go, okay, here we go.
Were you guys tracking it live pretty much? Like with Richie Okay.
There might've been some overdubbing. I'm quite sure. But yeah, overall it was a painful experience, yet people loved the record.
I love that record. It's
I
weird.
Do too. Like
it's
I like it as well. I mean, but I like the making of it was like, it was just like a horror show. I would think that maybe making the music wasn't that bad. It was just everything the politics surrounding making the music made it horrific. It wasn't the music that made it horrific.
And then, so the next record was Ted Templeman, right? He did Sailin' Shoes.
Oh, I think that was Robert Appare.
But that eventually sort of phased out and you guys produced yourselves, or Lowell was the producer after that. So
we kind of phased out. I think Robert Appare might have been on the other one. It was done at Clover Studios.
Okay.
And we were all over Hollywood in terms of recording and working. The notion of being in Little Feet originally, which is why we can still call it Little Feet, was Lowell and I talked about the philosophy of the band.
Which was what?
It's not just being a band. Who's in it and why? The philosophy is like, okay, we got drums, bass, guitar, keyboards. Do we want to augment them with horns? Mm-hmm. Do we want to bring in Sneaky Pete on pedal steel? Can Sneaky Pete fit in with us on a play a gig with us someplace? In other words, we were going to augment the band where and if we needed to.
Yeah.
If we wanted to play blues, it was somehow the genre of blues and Indian music a la Gandhi presented itself, then we would figure out a way to make those things work. It was, we wanted to lose the rules. And it's often the case with losing rules is you got to know what the rules are to lose them.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was a pretty healthy attitude towards playing music that was eclectic, challenging. And that was not something that you would sit there and go, we have to have every A, B, C section of a song match up. In that sense, when people said we were like Steely Dan, or later, or even at that time, that we were like the Grateful Dead, I never quite understood that, but I understood it later, in that we all held a very similar philosophy mm-hmm. of how we were creating music.
Okay.
We took the gloves off and said, look, you know, let's adhere to this, this, and that, and we'll throw the rest of it out the window.
All right, that was part one of my conversation with Bill Payne. Hope you're enjoying it. We will be back with part two 1 week from today. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you then. Thanks for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. Don't forget to follow us on social media, and please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify Podcasts. And you can find us online at makersandshakerspodcast.com. As always, thanks to Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver for help with research. And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.